Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the network, and whenever I get a chance, I try to do an interview with an exciting author who has an exciting new book. And this week, I'm very pleased to say that we have Matthew McWilliams on the show, and we'll be talking about his very timely book, The Rise of Trump, America's Authoritarian Spring. I should say that this is the first, I believe, of a series of books produced by Amherst College Press. And I believe the series is called Public Works, and it's a lot of books about topics of contemporary relevance, and this book certainly is timely and relevant. So, Matt, let me say, first of all, thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a late-in-life PhD. I started studying political science, I think when I was in the PhD program, I was 55, and I just finally finished my dissertation at 60. And my dissertation focused on something I was just fascinated with, and it was authoritarianism in America. And, you know, when I started work on the dissertation back about 3 years ago, authoritarianism was really a backwater of political science. An anachronism, arcane, people, you know, just didn't really study it. But I was fascinated by it because of a wonderful book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. And the thesis of the book is that was that authoritarianism was driving the political polarization that we've seen in America since the mid-1960s. And that captured my attention, and, you know, as a late-life PhD, you know, I'm not under the publisher-parish constraints of so many academics, and that's why I started studying authoritarianism. Before that, unlike what Breitbart, how Breitbart has described me, I'm not 26 years old. As I said, I'm 60. And for years, I've worked in politics in the United States, developing messages and communicating for candidates and issues and ideas.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Breitbart had me down. My article first came out on authoritarianism as a 26-year-old living in my parents' basement, living off of government grants, which I thought was, as my 30-year-old son pointed out, that would make it. He was born when I was negative four. But it shows you something about the world of journalism and fact-checking.
Yes.
No, that it's not all that good.
That's quite true. Well, you mentioned that authoritarianism is it's a traditional topic in political science, and I know a little bit about it because I was trained to be a Russian historian, Soviet historian, so it was an important concept for us way back when. So maybe you could do us the favor of telling us a little bit about the history of the study of authoritarianism.
Yeah, it is. It was the term and the study is really a product of post-World War II. And it's Adorno's book, as A-D-O-R-N-O, and several other authors, on the authoritarian personality. And it was an attempt to explain what happened in Europe, Nazi Germany, and how this could have happened. And was there a personality disposition behind this that led to the horrors that we saw in Europe during that period, World War II? There's also another book that it was almost simultaneous. It came before Adorno's book, but it focused on authoritarianism, and it's Eric Fromm's Fromm, Escape from Freedom. And he's from the Frankfurt School of Psychologists. And both of them are really good starting points for authoritarianism and the study of it. Eric Fromm's book is haunting, actually. I was just rereading it the other day, and he was talking about when authoritarianism is on the move, facts no longer matter. And we certainly, you know, see that today where things that are considered facts are real. Lies are facts, and facts are lies at times. So from Adorno onward, there was really a real flowering of the study of authoritarianism. Almost 2,000 some odd studies that came out, papers and other things that came out of academia on authoritarianism. And, you know, one of the real sort of debates in the field was how you measure it. There have been several measurement schemes that have been developed. One that is widely used and is quite good in many ways is Robert Altmaier's RWA scale, which is right-wing authoritarianism. The problem with that scale is that it's a little deterministic and says that authoritarianism is only right-wing. And what we know around the world is that authoritarians can be right-wing, left-wing, center, and come from all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the other question with the scale itself, it asks, it's a little tautological, i.e. it describes behaviors, and if you say, yes, those are my behaviors, then you're authoritarian. Whereas the scale that has been developed, Stanley Feldman developed it in the 90s and was first put on a political science poll in 1992, is a series of questions, just four, on child-rearing values. Values and approaches that have nothing to do with politics or authoritarian behavior. And those questions are then scaled. Answers to those questions are scaled, and people are put in an authoritarian scale. And the thing that is really fascinating about it is that people who test on these child ruling questions that they're likely to be disposed to authoritarianism actually end up taking or having behaviors and attitudes that are authoritarian in terms of politics. So it's quite remarkable. Here you have questions about child rearing that predict political behaviors.
So, but before we get to that and get to the survey you conducted and also the results of that survey, which are quite startling. So as I understand it correctly, then authoritarianism as a concept was originally produced by political scientists who were interested in explaining the rise of the Nazis, correct?
Yeah. And social scientists, political scientists and psychologists.
I see. Now,
and they were not trying to predict, they were trying to explain.
Retrospectively,
explain. How did this happen, and how can we stop it from happening in the future?
Now, in the 1950s and 60s, well, I remember from my time in graduate school in the late 1980s, that these concepts had fallen out of favor. Specifically, Soviet context, I don't know what the German historian said about it, but if you, I were to come into a Russian history seminar and say, well, the Soviet Union, that's the authoritarian personality, people would have, I don't know if they would have laughed at me, but I don't think they would have been favorably disposed. Can you talk a little bit about how the sort of significance or I guess the believability of these concepts declined in the, I don't know what period to put it, 60s, 70s, 80s?
Well, yeah, it was really within a few years of the authoritarian personality being published, there was a real backlash to it. And it really, a lot of the backlash came not with the concept of authoritarianism, though it's hard to define in some ways, but in the measurement. Because the authoritarian personality used at least three-dimensional scale to measure authoritarianism. And the problem with this, there are numerous problems with the scale. And one was, you know, a simple sampling problem, acquiescent bias, the way the scale was worded. But there were real questions raised about the validity of the scale, which led really, it was, you know, authoritarianism was sort of consigned to the backwater of American of political science and social psychology and many other different, you know, there are different scales, the C scale for conservatism, there's Rokic, the scale, there are several different things that arose to replace it.
I see. So your study kind of goes against the grain here. Could we say that?
Well, in the 90s, Stanley Feldman at a university of Stony Brook in New York, and others started to revivify it. And Altmaier also worked hard at revivifying it also. He's an academic in Canada. But Stanley Feldman came up with this four-question authoritarian battery, and first was put on the ANES, American National Election Survey poll, and he did an article with Karen Stenner, and it showed that this scale, authoritarian scale, was very predictive of what theory tells us would be authoritarian behavior.
I see.
And, you know, that, and then followed by Hetherington and Weiler and a few others, it put authoritarianism at least back on the academic calendar, but far, far down on the low end of it.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So it probably would be better to say that then your study is in the tradition of these studies from the 90s.
Right. And you know, they started in the 90s and moved on. Karen Stenner's book called The Authoritarian Dynamic came out in 2005. Hetherington and Weiler's book, which just won the Converse Award, one of the top awards in American political science, came out a few years after that. And so it's moved back. It's still not a mainstream study at all in political science.
Mm-hmm. So then let's get right to the definition of authoritarianism, because I think probably a lot of what follows will depend on that. So what is authoritarianism in your understanding?
Well, it is a disposition that to a certain specific set of actions. And one of those is obedience to authority, aggressive action towards norm breakers or anyone identified as outside, anyone really identified as the other. So submission to authority, aggression to outsiders. And I think one of the key things for listeners to know is that it is not conservatism. You know, that is a great mistake. Some conservatives are authoritarian, some actually liberals and independents, and moderates are authoritarians too. But authoritarianism at its root is an aversion to difference. Its taproot is intolerance, where conservatism is, you know, support of status quo. They're much, much different, in their locus and how they play out. And you can see that difference today playing out in the Republican Party, actually.
So you could see, just to give examples, you could see Stalin as an authoritarian and some of the behaviors that supported him as authoritarianism. I don't know, this is hypothetical, or Chavez or Castro, and these are figures on the left.
Right, right. You know, and that's one of the, even though, I mean, Robert Altmaier is a really phenomenal academic, and also has come up with, you know, his scale was the RWA scale, which is right-wing authoritarian. He also has a left-wing authoritarian scale now, but it is this presumption that by many that authoritarians are only on the right, but that's just wrong. Hugo Chavez is a perfect example of an authoritarian on the left.
I mean, you say at various points in the book, if I'm not incorrect, I read it a couple of days ago, but that fear is essential to authoritarianism and the behaviors that it prompts. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and this goes, there's sort of a difference between Stenner, Karen Stenner, authoritarian dynamic, and Hetherington, Weiler, and Sue, on the other side. And it's the question about authoritarian activation. And fear and threat there's a large literature that fear and threat activate authoritarianism. Now, Heather at all say that authoritarians are always on. They're ever vigilant. They are hardwired to be that way. So someone who's a one, most authoritarian on the scale, is always going to be vigilant. And so they aren't activated by threat and fear. It is people farther down the scale who become more authoritarian in their actions when they feel threatened. Center on the other side says, on the other hand, says that authoritarianism is latent until it's activated by fear. And then there are different types of fear. Stenner focuses on normative fear, which is, think of it this way, an easy way to think of it is attacks on conventions and norms. Social conventions and norms make activate authoritarians to take action. Gay marriage would be an attack on a norm. Marriage, as we initially conceived it, as it was constructed socially. Gay marriage would be an attack on that norm. It should elicit an authoritarian response. I think that authoritarians are generally, I agree with Hetherington and Weiler, that they are ever vigilant. But I think when threats are around, they are more reactive. I also think that Hetherington and Weiler are absolutely right that non-authoritarians act and react more like authoritarians when there is threat. Mm-hmm. And that threat can be a whole bunch. It can be threat to norms. It can be threat to society. It can be threats to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, so, the personal threat from terrorism is one of the questions Gallup and other people use to measure that personal threat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just to jump to the conclusion really quickly, you conduct a survey in which you show that people – answer certain questions about child rearing in a certain way, in an authoritarian way, are more likely to support Donald Trump. But before we get there and talk about the survey, that was a little teaser. Sure. I want to talk about Donald Trump and his rhetoric. I don't know the right word for it, because what he says and what he says he's going to do, because it doesn't fall neatly into baskets like for everybody else. So how does what Donald Trump say, if it does, activate that fear?
Yeah, and it's funny because it is that the word rhetoric probably doesn't work. I would say it's his Trump's message.
Yeah, I think manner. That's right.
Yeah, and his manner is strong man, stamina, strength. And just think of the second debate where he loomed in the background over Hillary Clinton. That's aggressive. It's assertive. And it is the type of posturing that some people like in a leader and want in a leader. They feel that shows strength and stamina, and that strength and stamina is authority, and it will protect them from the things they fear in the world.
Mm-hmm.
His message, and that's what really struck me when I'm finishing up my dissertation here. I got my nose to the grindstone. It's June of 2015. I'm working away. I'm not paying attention to much other than, pushing that rock up the hill. It's a big rock and it's a steep hill. And Donald Trump announces, I think it was June, 16th, was it? I did a little trouble to look. And, I'm a political junkie in a lot of ways. I listened to his speech and I was floored. Mexicans, rapists, you've heard the language over and over again. That was language. And that was a definition of the other that has not been broadcast or spoken in American politics other than by, no one's really ever said that. Pat Buchanan has gone far in terms of targeting immigrants as the other. And obviously, his book State of Emergency does that. But in the 90s, when he was running, he didn't go as far as Trump. And then as Trump, you know, so it is the identification of the other. It is policy statements like we're going to build a wall, we're going to make Mexico pay for it, that, you know, on their face are pretty, you know, not possible. That will not happen policy-wise, but they're strong, and they tap into fear of the other. Muslims, we're going to prohibit Muslims from coming to this country. We are going to close down mosques. Why? Because they're different than, you know, some, at least Donald Trump and some other people's view of America. They are the other. So he targeted group after group as the other. I mean, Muslims, Latinos, as the other. And he said we have to take action against them. And that is a signal fire, a clarion call to authoritarians.
Mm-hmm. Well, then
you add the backdrop of what was going on. Jeb Bush had talked about we have to, you know, immigrants come here as an act of love. And you remember the debate where Trump went out and attacked him for that and say it's not an act of love. It's law breaking. We need order. We need law. There are rapists there, whatever. And so he drew a line there. Then there was the Paris terrorist attacks. And if you look at polling, that was an inflection point for Trump, because Trump's response was stop all immigrant Muslims from coming into this country. Whereas Ben Carson, who was doing well at that time, didn't respond in that very clear way and lost share. And then that was followed, obviously, by the San Bernardino attacks. And those things taken together, you know, were clearing call to authoritarians and crystallized his authoritarian support.
Mm-hmm. I think what surprised everyone, and I was listening too, was the degree to which voters, and particularly in Iowa, I lived in Iowa for a long time, responded to this message as if they were all waiting there quietly for someone to come and say it.
That's the latent authoritarianism that Karen Stenner would talk about.
Mm-hmm. And where was that before he said it? Was it just brewing in people's hearts, or had this desire, or I don't want to call it xenophobia, but had this, I don't know what to call it. I really don't. I'm kind of at a loss for words because I don't want to insult the people of Iowa, who I love very much. Where did that come from?
The authoritarianism, the disposition towards authoritarianism is extant in certain people. It's part, you know, it's socially learned and partially inherited. I mean, that's what Stenner would say. Altmaier would say it's all socially learned. And it's in people. It doesn't mean it's not deterministic. It's got to be turned on, right?
Right.
But it's there until it's turned on. And there have to be conditions that turn it on. One is the presence of threat. We have these terrorist incidents, right, that occur. We've really had, since 9/11, been in, I was just writing about this today, a social science experiment of threat. We've been under threat and told we're threatened since 9/11, day in and day out. And so we're more on edge. We're more vigilant. So you have threat, extant, threat in reality, you know, San Bernardino, Paris, on television. And then you have a leader who is getting an incredible amount of media coverage. You look at the coverage, and in some months, Trump got 30-1 media coverage over his opponents.
Mm-hmm.
Broadcasting that message. And so, you know, think of it, the gas is out, the gas is, threat is pouring gas on the fire. Trump's message lights the fire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the larger problem is what happens after November 8th. Because once activated, authoritarians are hard to put back in the box.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about the sort of empirical core of this book, and that is the survey that you conducted and the results of that survey. Could you describe both of those for us?
Yeah, you know, the survey, as I was sitting and watching this unfold, I finally said, I have to do a national survey on this. And I was fortunate, you know, my dissertation committee said, you can't write any more for your dissertation. Too long. Stop it. But this is a really interesting question. I have some wonderful professors on my dissertation committee, all younger than I am, wonderful people, and smarter than I am. And I put together a poll questionnaire. They reviewed it and made some really brilliant comments that made it so much better. And then we fielded it through the University of Massachusetts. We fielded an 1,800 sample national poll. And we fielded it online December 10th through the 15th. And the context of this is important. It's about a month before the Iowa caucuses, right? And it was a week after the San Bernardino terrorist attack shootings, which obviously came after Paris. So terrorism and threat should be on people's minds. They've seen it on television. They should be worried about it. So we fielded a poll. Data comes back. I was out working in Minnesota doing qualitative research, focus groups in Duluth. I remember the data appeared in my, you know, the 1,800 sample responses to, you know, what is a 40 question poll, I think, came into my inbox. And it was 11 o'clock at night and I was tired. We've been doing qualitative research all day. I said, oh, I got to look at this. And, you know, I looked at the first set of questions and I started to run some basic statistical tests. And I was just floored because, you know, you have a theory, a hypothesis. My hypothesis was very simple, that if we polled, we would find that people who tested high on the authoritarian scale supported Donald Trump and no other candidate in the Republican Party, because he was the one who was projecting the authoritarian message and manner. And what I found was that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, that doesn't happen often in research. You have a theory and it actually plays out. Usually it's not clear, or it's really clear that you were wrong. But here it wasn't. So, you know, I went through the data, I double checked it, put it away, came back to it, checked it again. Then I tried to knock down the hypothesis of the results in any way I could by just building what would only be considered a Christmas tree model, where you put in every variable you can think of that might soak up and make authoritarianism not important. And it just hung in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I tried, you know, all sorts of different other approaches, MLOGIT, you know, all these different analysis, but was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote up a little article. I thought, well, this is really interesting. And I wrote up just a short, you know, two-page little article. I sent it off first to the New York Times. They came back and said, this is really interesting, but we don't have time for it. And then I said, well, no, I've had things published in Politico before. So I'll send over to Politico. They came back and said, we're very interested. And really, we went back and forth for 3 weeks, editing it, honing it, checking the data again before they published it. So it was done end of December, but we spent 3 weeks editing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put the headline on it. The clickbait headline, which just I rue the day that they did this, but they were great editors. You know, the one weird trait that describes Donald Trump. It's much more complex than that, but that generated. And the moment that that came out, I was having lunch or a breakfast with my son and his wife to be. My wife and I were, and my phone just started going nuts.
Yeah,
and I think it, you know, gathered like 250,000 shares in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. If you remember, could you tell us what the really predictive questions were, the ones about child rearing?
Oh, sure. There are four. It's a simple scale, and it's not my scale. I mean, it's a scale that's been used by political scientists studying this since 1992. And it asks, you know, there are a number of qualities that people believe children should have. Every person thinks some qualities are more important than others. Here are four pairs of desirable qualities. Please choose which quality from each pair is more important. And the pairs are respect for elders or independence. Respect for elders, that's the authoritarian answer.
Mm-hmm.
Self-reliance or obedience. Obedience is the authoritarian. Good manners or curiosity. Good manners. Being considerate or being well-behaved. Being well-behaved. And so if you answer those four in the authoritarian, you would score a one on the scale. If you answer, you know, independence or the others, you'd score a zero on the scale. And there are people who fall in between. And so what I did is I took that scale, all the people in the questionnaire, I looked at only likely voters in the Republican primary or caucus, because it was that's where we were back then, right? Likely voters in the Republican primary caucus. I think I was like 550 people. And I said, and I looked at if they supported Trump or not. And what we found is that authoritarians were statistically, in a statistically significant and substantive way, were more likely to support Donald Trump. Really a stunning finding in so many ways. And, you know, it wasn't just that. I mean, there was ideology was in the model. Race, sex, you know, race is not going to be a large player in the Republican primary because I think there are only 14 African-Americans in the 554 sample. But it's just that's just the way it is. But education, income, church attendance, all these variables that should be predictive of political behavior just washed out of the model. It was authoritarianism that soaked up all the effect, or that was all the effect. Mm-hmm. Really fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then the second model, I added in threat. I had threat in the first model. I added an interaction term between threat and authoritarianism and everything else. And then threat dropped down with just authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is very—it's very interesting and very shocking. You're right; this doesn't happen very often. I don't know if any hypothesis I've ever had has been borne out like that. That might be one time in a whole career.
Yeah, I mean, well, and what was you know? And I felt so. Well, it's one poll, so we know it's a good poll, but you know, one out of 20 polls is wrong. So, but the great thing is that Vox came out. I talked to them about this. They were real interested in it. And they said, well, we're going to check it. And I said, let's go for it. And I gave them the questions. They had Morning Consult do it. Mark Hetherington advised them. They went out about probably 4 weeks after I did, maybe 5 weeks. They found the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, that's interesting. That's good. Good. So,
yeah, well, that made me feel good because I felt a little – naked out there.
Yeah. I guess the first question I have about this is it seems to me that it bears on the question whether the Republican Party, that really is the most significant question to say. I'm not going to say that I know that Hillary Clinton is going to win, but it certainly looks like she's going to win. But the Republican Party will trundle on somehow. But it seems to me that Trump's discovery of this cohort of people who behave in this way and can be triggered in this way does have some significance for the future of the Grand Old Party. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it definitely does. And this goes back to Hetherington and Wyler. Hetherington and Wyler said that authoritarians have been sorting out of Democratic Party, out of independence, towards the Republican Party, and that a large part of this polarization we're seeing is because of authoritarian movement into the Republican Party. As this has occurred, and they have a model that shows this, and then I extended their model with 12 years of data. I extended it to 20 years with building a 13,000 national sample from polls, and showed that, yeah, actually, their data, their the effect that they were seeing is correct, and it extends for another 8 years. Mm-hmm. My effect wasn't as strong as that they found, but it was still there and statistically significant. So you have authoritarians moving into the Republican Party over time. They're still authoritarian Democrats. They're still authoritarian independents, but they've been moving into the Republican Party. And at some point, there are enough of them in the party to make a difference in a nominating primary selection system if they're activated. And this was the year when they got activated, and I think there was a tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what does that mean for the Republican Party going forward? And you can see the difference in the split in the party. There are the Paul Ryan Republicans who are conservatives, status quo conservatives, and then there are these, they're not Tea Party. It is an authoritarian bent of people led by Trump and other people who have started to jump on board, Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, others. And so I think that there is a split in the Republican Party right now that will express itself, continue to express itself. And I think that they're looking at basically an internal war, the equivalent to what was fought after Goldwater lost in 64.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this time, I think the it will either lead to a split or a nuanced authoritarian becoming the nominee in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult for me to understand. I was going to say it's difficult for me to understand how the twain can possibly meet, the Ryans and the Trumps. They just seem dispositionally such they're such very different people. And so Jeb Bush, yeah, he's just like from another planet compared to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I don't think they can. You know, and you've seen it in the, you know, I look at what Ryan and others have done is just Neville Chamberlain-like appeasement of Trump. The way you stop an authoritarian movement is by strongly voicing an alternative many of the unconstitutional values and policies that Trump is espousing.
Mm-hmm.
But that can't come from, it comes from the left or the Democrats, but it's much more effective within the party.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that if Hillary Clinton wins, we don't know that now, but if she does, Republicans will be unified in delegitimizing her, which is the rigged election is the new birtherism, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they will be totally fractured on how to move forward. Mm-hmm. And that's where the Paul Ryan, Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, John McCain versus Trump and Trump acolytes, the twain will not meet.
Mm-hmm. And it seems very unlikely, given Donald Trump's personality, that he's going to step aside in favor of the grand old party reuniting. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think you're wrong about that at all. He will. I don't know what he'll do. I mean, he's totally unpredictable. My sense is he probably would want to be a kingmaker in the 2020 nominating process. So people who want his, endorsement will have to come and kiss the ring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably right. So I'm thinking of an electoral strategy for
a little bit of a mafia. You shouldn't use the mafia term, kissing
yeah.
the ring.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of an electoral strategy that would actually work for the Republicans. And one question that occurs to me is that it may be the case, there's a reasonable hypothesis to put it in the terms of political science, that that this the activation of this pretty large cohort of authoritarians, most of them being Republicans, is really dependent on Trump. Once Trump is gone, then they will revert to the norm.
You know, they could. That would all be an interesting thing to see. But I think the counter to that is more likely, and that there Trump when Trump leaves the field. I'm not sure he'll ever actually leave the field. I think he's going to be talking about a rigged election forever. But it creates a vacuum, and any political candidate who's an entrepreneur and doesn't really have a core set of values except to win, we'll see that there is a large group of people who can be harnessed and who become monolithic support that's hard to chip away. And that basket of voters becomes something in a primary that's determinant, so you're going to want it. I just think what you're likely to see is a more nuanced version of Trump, carrying the same messages, but a little bit more coded.
Mm-hmm. And probably not running himself. He's done after this time, you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, you never know. I mean, so unpredictable. But so I can't answer that. But will someone take the Trump position? Yeah. Absolutely, I think. Uh-huh. And, you know, if Trump weren't so ham-handed politically, or so reactive. He's not ham-handed. He's so reactive. He had, I think, an excellent chance of winning the presidency. And he looked right before the first debate. He was within a point nationally, a point and a half, of Clinton. But he has just continues to put a target on his back. I don't think it's a losing strategy. It's not a strategy that I like as an American. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a losing strategy for Republicans to nominate a Trump-lite.
Right. So I'm not going to ask you what will happen to the United States if Trump will win. Nobody knows that, I suppose. Although you see a lot of speculation about it, which I find kind of humorous. But I will ask you this. What will happen to the Republican Party if he wins?
Oh, well, I think it's much easier for the Republican Party if he wins. Paul Ryan will lose the speakership. I think if he wins, the Republican Party will probably hold the Senate. If he loses, they won't. So if he wins, Paul Ryan's gone his speakership, and there will be a cleaning of house in the Republican Party, and you're either with Trump or against him. Mm-hmm. And there will be a cleansing within the Republican Party, in my opinion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think they'll move to the right. And also within that, I think they'll lose some people, but there'll be others in the country, in voters, who are authoritarian and now sitting in the Democratic Party, who I bet would will hasten the partisan sorting between Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, this is what I was actually getting after here, is that if Trump wins and gains a certain amount of legitimacy, if you won't see more people answering yes to those four questions who are now Democrats.
There are a bunch of Democrats who answer yes to that. I don't think their answers to those questions will change, but their partisan ID will. Those questions are there shouldn't be much movement on those questions at all, because they measure disposition. But the behavior, which is where you vote, right now they're Democrats who are authoritarians, and their partisanship is still making them vote Democratic.
Yeah.
On the flip side, and this is why I'm studying in a poll that goes in the field next week, there are non-authoritarians in the Republican Party who are voting for Trump because of their partisan ID, their partisan identification with the Republican Party. Over time, looking at 20 years of data, Hetherington and Weiler started this, I extended it, what we see is higher amounts of defections of non-authoritarian Republicans to Democratic candidates and Democratic authoritarians to Republican candidates.
Mm-hmm.
except for African Americans who are authoritarian because their race, voting for Obama, trumped their authoritarianism. Mm-hmm.
I see. So let's talk a little bit about your future work. We've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it.
Sure.
What exactly are you working on now?
Well, I just actually I'm about to head to Europe to a conference called Shaping the Future of Europe, where I'm speaking about authoritarianism in Europe, because these four questions, I put these questions on national polls in Europe. They haven't been asked there more than once or twice in Europe. And what we found is that these questions are predictive of alt-right, nationalist, anti-immigrant, and neo-Nazi party membership in Europe. So, for example, in Britain, authoritarians are more likely to support the United Kingdom Independence Party and to have voted for Brexit. Mm-hmm. Authoritarians are more likely to support the National Front in France, Marine Le Pen. Authoritarians are more likely to support the Swedish Democrats, who are an anti-immigrant Nazi party. Mm-hmm. Authoritarians are more likely to support, obviously, the neo-Nazi party in Germany, but also the neo-Nazi Light Party alternative for Germany, AFG. And so, I mean, it is stunning. The theory is that these questions are cross-cultural, cross-geography, cross-politics, and the reality is we found in Europe that they are. Mm-hmm. So I'm heading out to there and to talk about this finding, because there are gigantic elections coming up in Germany and France, especially in 2017, that are very important to the future of civil society and democracy in the EU. This authoritarian activation has happened not just in the United States, it's happened in Europe also.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds fascinating, and I hope that when that research comes out, we can talk to you again. And let me say to everyone who's been listening to this podcast, thank you very much for listening. I'm Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and today we've been talking with Matt McWilliams about his new book, The Rise of Trump, America's Authoritarian Spring. It's just out from Amherst College Press. So thank you to the audience for listening. And Matt, let me say thank you for being on the show.
Oh, Marshall, thanks so much for having me. I hope I didn't bore anyone.
I don't think you did. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your question.